Hello and welcome to another episode of The Open Floor. I'm Ben Golliver. You know, Andrew Sharpe's triumphant return is right around the corner, but it's not here quite yet. So this week I have a really fun tribute episode. Now, Andrew and I have always wondered for months, why are there so many hardcore basketball fans in Australia? We just get email after email from down under. So to answer questions about that community, how it came to existence, why they're so locked into hoops down there when they have so many other sports to kind of follow, I decided to call the foremost expert in Australian NBA basketball fans. That's none other than Lee Ellis. Now, Lee Ellis is one of the panelists on The Starters on NBA TV. He was on the podcast formerly known as The Basketball Jones with guys like Skeets, Taz, Trey Kirby, Matt, JD. I'm sure you guys are familiar with those guys. Lee is going to explain sort of his path to covering the NBA here in the United States from Australia. He's going to talk about what it's like back home, why are there so many fans down there, and just give us the ins and outs of kind of his journey to the NBA. It's a really fun conversation. Hey guys, if you have any questions for us during this offseason, I know it's kind of the dead time of year, go ahead and email them to openfloormail@gmail.com. Again, openfloormail@gmail.com. I appreciate all the questions I have received here in the last week or two. Also, don't forget 5-star reviews on Apple Podcasts. All right, without further ado, here's my conversation with Lee Ellis of NBA TV's The Starters. Well, thanks a lot for joining us, Lee.
Thanks very much for having me, Ben. I appreciate the opportunity.
My pleasure. Hey, so we always get this question here at The Open Floor for people about, like, how do we get into basketball, right? And when I answer that question, I think back to, you know, being a kid, and I grew up in Portland, Oregon. You know, there's a basketball team there. They were pretty good at the time. There's some sneaker companies nearby. It was kind of right in the middle of Michael Jordan's heyday, dream team. And, my dad grew up playing basketball. And, you know, he went to Michigan State at the same time Magic was there. So he loved it. It was kind of a natural kind of hand-me-down generational type thing. I was totally immersed in the sport as a kid. And then I'm wondering, you know, I've followed you for years and years, and I just think of all those different factors I just mentioned, so many of them are probably different for a guy like yourself growing up in Australia. I mean, how do you even get into basketball or NBA basketball specifically as a kid? And was that your first sports love, or was it something you just sort of discovered out of the blue?
Well, I guess it all starts with me. I'm the third of three boys, and my dad and mum were very active. You know, they played a lot of sports at home, you know, tennis and basketball and things like that. And so pretty much from as early as I can remember, I used to go up to the local basketball stadium with my brothers and my dad and watch them play. And you know, when you're young, you know, like sort of say before you're 10 years old, you go up there and you learn to be the scorer, in fact, and you sort of learn how to score and you watch how the games are played and how things work. And, it was sort of naturally, it just sort of came to me that because we sort of did that all together as a family a lot, that basketball just sort of was always in my sort of life. And so I was intrigued from it from the start. I mean, we played in Australia, we play everything growing up, you know, that's our sort of claim to fame, I guess, you know, in the world is that we want to be athletes and we want to be, contribute to the sports world. And so we try every sport, you know, cricket and tennis and golf and swimming and, you know, Aussie rules football and rugby and all those sports. And for me, I played all those growing up as a kid, but basketball was the one that really stood out to me for whatever reason. I just really enjoyed it and I really enjoyed the competition. And I think that, as I started playing competition basketball when I was probably 9 or 10 years old, we knew about the NBA in Australia back then. This is in the late 80s. You know, we knew about Magic Johnson and Michael Jordan and Larry Bird and Dr. J, but there was no access to it because there was obviously no internet and there was no cable TV. So really getting highlights of the NBA was really, really tough. So, you know, there was always that intrigue. And, I always wanted to find out a way to try to watch a game or to just get a little bit of coverage. And the big moment in my life, really, and I'm sure fans who have followed the Basketball Jones and the Starters as well know that the 1987 All-Star game was the first game that I got on VHS. My brother, my oldest brother, Nick, came home from school one day and he had this copy of this All-Star game. And so we were like, all right, put it on, let's watch it. And that was really an amazing moment for me because I was watching this game and it was an incredible game. And it wasn't just one or two players. Like it wasn't just, say, the Lakers versus, you know, the Milwaukee Bucks or something like that. It was all the stars at the time playing together in what was an incredible game. And for anyone who doesn't know the story, you know, that game goes to overtime and Rolando Blackman hits these two free throws. It sends the game to overtime with no time left and the West goes on to win it. And that really was the first time that I thought, right, I've got to try to get more access to the NBA. And so from there, I went to my local news agent and you know, asked them, say, do you have any basketball magazines? And they sort of had one or two. And then I used to just kept going in there to harass them and say, look, do you have any more of these NBA magazines? And they used to actually save them for me at the back. And I used to go to the back of the news agent and say, you know, Lee Ellis, do you have any NBA magazines? And they're like, oh, yes, Lee, here you are. And, you know, these were only probably like $3 or $4 in US currency, but with the exchange rate and just the shipping fees and getting it to Australia, I was spending, you know, maybe $8 or $9 on a magazine, which was all my pocket money at the time. But I just consumed everything I could. And then there's another story as well. A good friend of mine, his dad worked at Qantas Airways, and he was sort of involved in the cleaning and the maintenance of airplanes. And when the planes would come in from America, they would have the USA Today on it, and so he would always get the USA Today and bring it in for me. And crazily me, I don't know why I did it at the time, I paid my friend to get the USA Today because it had all the box scores and little bits of information about the NBA on it. And I just wanted everything I could, and I'd read these box scores, and I'd read the little, you know, one sentence or one paragraph on a game and just consume it all. And I remember I told my dad one day, because he gave me some pocket money and it was gone the next day, and he said, you know, what happened to your pocket money? And I said, I paid Tomo for the USA Today newspapers. And he's like, what are you wasting your money doing that for? And I didn't have a good reason, but it's one of those stories that I like to sort of tell now, because I think, in, you know, considering the career path that I've chosen and where I am right now, it paid off, you know, because some of those things that I remember reading and seeing at the time are somehow relevant to what I do now. So, you know, for me, I was just passionate very early on about basketball. I love playing. I love watching it. And the NBL, the Australian League, was quite big in the late 80s and early 90s. It's not quite so big now. But, you know, so basketball was very much a big part of my life early on. And, you know, then as I sort of grew and as I grew up and, you know, things like the internet and cable TV became more of a factor, it allowed me to at least watch things a little bit closer. And you know, so I started, and also in the late 80s in Australia, they started playing one game a week. And it was like, it was on Friday night at like midnight. And so I used to set the DVR and, the VHS at the time, and tape all those games. And I'd watch them over and over and over again. And, you know, that was all I had access to as far as watching games at the time. But I used to just watch them, you know, as often as I could. And, you know, it was a really incredible moment, because I know that a lot of basketball fans in Australia were just dying to get some NBA coverage. And when we finally got it, people were just rejoicing, even if it was, like I say, one game that may have been 3 or 4 weeks delayed as far as when it was actually played. But we didn't care. We just wanted to watch it, and it was great. And, you know, the first season that we got was the 88-89 season. And anyone who remembers the 1989 playoffs, they were an incredible playoffs. Obviously, you had Jordan and the Bulls going all the way to the Eastern Conference Finals. And Jordan had the shot in the first round against Cleveland. Then they upset the Knicks in the second round. And then they were actually leading the Pistons 2-1 at one stage in that series before losing in six. And then in the West, you had the Lakers who swept all the way through to the NBA Finals and then got swept themselves by the Pistons. And there was just some really incredible moments in that playoff series. And I remember, you know, a specific game. In fact, it was the Lakers and the Sonics game 4 of the Western Conference semifinals. And the Sonics were up 29 points in the second quarter, and it was an incredible game. And then the Lakers came back and won that game and ended up sweeping the series. And I've still got that game on tape at home somewhere. And it was just, you know, for me, I watched these games over and over and over again, and I started to accumulate a lot more knowledge about the league and the game and the players. And, you know, from there, things just took off for me.
No, that's amazing. I mean, you came right in for the golden era, I think, of what people would think of the late 80s with, you know, Jordan's first cresting and some of those, you know, memories that we're still watching on highlight reels today. I'm curious, though, like when you were first going to that gym, I mean, how many people are at that gym? Is it thousands of fans watching these local games? Is it a very small community? And then, like, once you're starting to get these box scores and you're picking up these magazines and you're kind of making those investments like you're talking about and how it would pay off for you career-wise like 30 years later, I mean, do you have fans at, you know, fellow friends at school you can talk to about this stuff? Or are you like the one guy in the class who's, you know, decked out in, you know, probably like starter jackets and NBA gear and just everybody's kind of looking at like, what are you even talking about? I mean, was there really a community at that point in Australia or not yet?
Yeah, no, there was a community, but I probably was the nerdiest out of a lot of them because, you know, people were interested in things. you know, people were interested certainly in seeing the highlights of Jordan and Magic and everyone like that, Larry Bird. But I was the one who was like digging into like who's 12th man on the roster and, you know, what's this guy going to be doing? And, you know, whenever people would talk about Michael Jordan, you know, I would almost try to test them and say, well, you know Michael Jordan, but do you know Brad Sellers as well for the Chicago Bulls? You know what he's doing and, you know, how tall he is and what number he wears and all that sort of stuff. And the town I grew up in, Sunbury, in the late 80s, it was approximately about 30,000 people. So it was a fairly small community, but it was a very social community as well. And so when you would go to the basketball stadium, it was kind of a social interaction as well. And so you would have like adults would play Mondays, Tuesdays and Wednesdays, and then it would be more for the kids and under 18s and below on basically a Friday night and a Saturday afternoon. So there was sort of, I would probably spend, you know, maybe two or three nights a week at the basketball stadium, you know, either watching my dad or my brothers play and then playing myself on weekends. And then as I sort of turned to become a teenager, like 13 or 14, then you start playing in some of the lower leagues with the older men who are kind of retiring at the end of their careers, you know, in their sort of 50s, as you get to learn to play with the men. And then, you know, as you progress, you start to play with, you know, really good players when you're in your sort of late teens, early 20s. So the competition was really good. And, you know, you got to make some great friendships with some people, and there was some pretty good rivalries as well between the teams. So there was definitely, you know, basketball was very passionate in Sunbury, but I don't really remember too many people sort of being able to go into depth about statistics or sort of, you know, rare players. Like if I threw a Liddell Echols out there, not a whole lot of people would have known who I was talking about. But, you know, for me, that was sort of what drove me as well, is I just wanted to know everything I could about the whole league. And, you know, if anyone wanted to talk to me about the NBA, I was happy to sort of share my information and knowledge with them, although it didn't sort of last too long, those conversations, when I started getting too deep into it. And people just really wanted to hear about Jordan and Isaiah Thomas and, you know, all the sort of the sort of more marketable names and players. But
what you're describing is similar to like us here in the United States with soccer. You know, I mean, I remember in like the mid 90s when the video games first started, you know, we start to get really introduced, like casual fans would get introduced to some of the biggest stars, and you might know five players, but you wouldn't know, you know, the seventh most important player on Brazil or Argentina, for example.
Right.
Yeah, no, that's fascinating. So when you're growing up in that basketball community, I mean, you're kind of contemporaneous with, you know, maybe guys like Andrew Bogut and Patty Mills and some of this generation of guys. Could you, I mean, now you look back on it, could you foresee those guys being able to come up through that Australian basketball system and playing on the NBA level? Or did that seem kind of impossible for, you know, a lot of guys? I mean, there's quite a few Australian players in the league right now. When you look back on that time, like the late 80s, early 90s, Australia's basketball community, did it seem like it was going to be able to produce NBA quality players in volume?
I mean, obviously, you know, hindsight is 20/20, but I know that the level of athleticism and athletic ability of guys that I played basketball with, and not just basketball, but Aussie rules football and cricket and tennis and all those sports, there was definitely some guys who stood out a lot more than others. And again, because people played so passionately, I'm not all that surprised to see so many guys now trickling through the NBA. And I mean, I say trickling through, but of course, you know, you've had Andrew Bogut and Ben Simmons, both number one picks. And technically, you can throw Kyrie Irving in there as number one pick. He was born in Melbourne, but he wasn't technically an Australian as far as, you know, he sort of went through the Australian schooling system and things like that. But, you know, I remember because I played high school basketball and I was like, you know, probably ninth or tenth guy on the roster. We had a really good team and we made the all state finals twice. And we came runner up both times. And when I look back at those times, I mean, you know, there was some really good basketball competition for young guys growing up. So to me now, to see, like, say, Ben Simmons being the number one pick last year, Dante Exum a couple of years ago, he was number five pick by the Jazz. And obviously Dellavedova, Mills and Bogut and those guys you talk about. I'm not that surprised. I think the only problem is with Australian basketball is if you're really good at basketball, you're not going to play in the local, in the NBL league. You obviously have your sights set primarily on the NBA. But then if failing that, you want to go somewhere in Europe or even China because those leagues are just bigger and they pay more money. So the Australian league itself is not a great platform in that respect, because I think in what you're getting now is a lot more guys who can't make it in other leagues who are falling back to Australia, because Australia just doesn't have the money to compete with Europe or other leagues around the world that can offer bigger contracts. So, you know, I know that the league has gone through some changes a lot over the last sort of 10 to 15 years, but still at that grassroots level, at the school kids level, a lot of guys now who follow the NBA, because it's not like it was for me where I couldn't see games every week or anything like that. These guys now can watch games, they watch the NBA League Pass, and they get the live feed of basically any national TV broadcast in Australia. So kids are growing up on NBA basketball in Australia, and they see like the impact Steph Curry's had over the last couple of years, and every kid now wants to be a Steph Curry. It's funny, one of my friends I was talking to not too long ago, you know, he's got two boys. They're, you know, sort of early teenagers, and he was saying that all the kids now in Australia think they're Steph Curry. You know, they want to shoot from, you know, 5 feet behind the 3-point line. You know, whereas when I grew up, everyone tried to dunk like Michael Jordan, but obviously, you know, not many people could do that. But Steph Curry has changed the way that guys how the game is played now, and they actually feel like, you know, I can actually do this, because you don't need to be 6'6" like Jordan was to be able to jump as high as you can. You only need to be able to shoot the ball. And so, you know, Steph Curry's having an incredible impact on basketball all around the world. I'm sure, you know, you can go to any country and there's going to be kids wearing the Steph Curry jerseys. But that's certainly having a big impact in Australia.
Totally. I mean, it's all those kids that are aggravating Mark Jackson, right? I mean, like, scoot in. You don't need to shoot from 35 feet. I mean, he went off about that a couple years ago during a broadcast. Hey, a couple other touchstone events I wanted to ask you about. Can you reflect on the importance of, like, the Dream Team? Because we always hear how important that is around the globe. And then also maybe weigh that against, like, the Sydney Olympics, because I imagine that was probably a pretty big moment for Australian basketball as well. And then some of the players you mentioned getting drafted recently, I know they're kind of like second-generation guys, right? Like, their dads were professional athletes, either, you know, Americans who lived in Australia and competed in the Australian Basketball League, or they, you know, they just happened to be over there. You know, kind of timeline-wise, I mean, how important do you think it is for some of these guys to just have been raised sort of in basketball families, almost like NBA basketball families as expats, and then those Olympic events? I mean, I know you got introduced to the NBA a few years before the Dream Team by that 1987 All-Star game, but do you remember people kind of crowding around TVs and watching the 92 Olympics, and also just in 2000 when you're hosting it? I imagine that was like a big basketball party.
Yeah, well, definitely 92 was a huge moment, because a lot of, you know, I think the Dream Team were probably the first real, you know, rock star type team at an Olympic Games. I mean, I know that in the past we've had Carl Lewis and, you know, guys who have stood out to be, you know, fantastic at their particular event, but the Dream Team was this whole class of not just like good guys, but Hall of Fame guys, legends, except for Christian Leighton, of course, but, you know, no disrespect to him, but compared to those other guys, you know, the David Robinsons, the Scottie Pippins, the Jordan and Magic, I mean, these are some of the most famous players you've seen of all time. But it was interesting, because I taped every single game, and even the warm-up games that the US had over here against Cuba, and I can't remember exactly who they were now, but I wanted to consume everything, because for me, that was my golden ticket. It was like all these players basically playing an all-star game every single time they're going out in the Olympics, and you know, it was going to be great. But in some ways, I kind of got annoyed, because a lot of people were saying, oh, gee, this guy Clyde Drexler is pretty good, and this guy Chris Mullin, he can really shoot the ball. And I'm like, yeah, I've been telling you guys about these guys for the last couple of years, and you're only just starting to realize. And so it annoyed me that a lot of people, their first real exposure to guys outside of those big names like Larry and Michael and you know, Magic Johnson, and they were really seeing how good these other guys were as well. And so it was fun, but I was also like, I felt in some ways validated that I'd been you know, talking about the NBA for so long and finally seeing some results.
Yeah, you're the original Australian NBA hipster, Lee. I mean, clearly you're just you know, you were the early adopter, right?
Exactly. It was kind of like, yeah, now everyone wants to be an NBA fan, and I've been, you know, following it for the last 5 or 6 years. But, you know, in 2000, actually, I wasn't in Australia for Sydney. I was actually living in England at the time, but I followed it closely. And I know that obviously after the Dream Team of 92, you know, the expectations were much bigger on the US, because everyone sort of wanted to see if they could sort of replicate the dominance and the power of that and the grace of that 92 team. But there were also a couple of moments, I think, following it, like the sort of 94 team and then the 96 Olympic team and Atlanta here, that kind of upset a few basketball fans as well, because there was there weren't quite the same grace and elegance of that 92 Dream Team. There was a bit more of a sort of loud mouth. You know, you got guys like Gary Payton there, who's obviously, you know, that's what he's known for, being a talker. And I think that sort of turned off a few people as well from that team. I don't think the fans were as endeared as much to those following teams after the Dream Team, because they just seemed to be a little bit more brash and a little bit more arrogant. And obviously they went out and crushed everyone anyway, but they just didn't do it in the same style as the original. So there was a little bit of a feeling, I think, that, you know, people appreciated the skills and the athleticism of the players. And obviously, you know, guys like Vince with that incredible dunk over Freddie Weiss was a sort of landmark moment. But I don't think fans were quite as just enamored by the following Dream Teams. You know, I think things have turned a little bit again now. I think, you know, fans just really love to see which sort of group of players the Americans going to send. But I think if you go back, I think everyone's still going to have a little bit of more sentimental value just to that Dream Team, because of where it came from and the legends on that list, that, you know, they were some of the greatest players of all time in NBA history, and they're all sort of playing together at once, and they did it all as we expected them to do it as well. You know, pretty much crushed everyone. And, you know, Charles Barkley, obviously, he was a bit of a lightning rod there, but I think at the time it was... It was still charming, you know, and I don't think it was quite the same for a couple of Dream Teams after that. But
for sure. I mean, they kind of set like an impossible standard, right? I mean, everything after the 92 team is like, you're never going to be able to keep up with them on or off the court when you don't have peak MJ and you don't have the newness factor. And like you're saying, I mean, when you're, you know, maybe getting into some, you know, off-court trash talk and all that stuff, I mean, it's always a little bit different. I do think they did turn a little bit, I think, in the international eyes to sort of being villains almost, or kind of maybe even bullies, maybe, you know, would be a way to put it.
Yeah, I think that's right. And, you know, like I say, guys like Gary Payton, if you follow the NBA, you knew exactly what you were getting out of a guy like him. You know, he loved to talk trash and loved to get into his opponent's face. But I think the 92 team just didn't need to do that. And that's what I think people sort of more liked about them. They played in a more gentlemanly way, although, you know, the certainly the aggressiveness from Michael Jordan and Scottie Pippen, particularly against Croatia, we know against Tony Kukoc, they really wanted to make a point against him, but they sort of did it within the confines of the rules and the spirit of the game. There was no sort of you know, real headlines in the media or anything like that. And again, Charles Barkley had some comments, and I know that even John Stockton had some comments at the time about not living in, staying in the Olympic Village. But again, I think it was all new and it was all fresh. And then, you know, when they played the game, they played the way they did, people didn't sort of feel like they were, you know, the sort of, not that same cockiness that we saw in, you know, sort of the later 90s teams. But, you know, that was also, as well, like you mentioned, they had such an incredible high standard that it was very, very difficult whoever came after them to repeat that sort of performance and to have that same sort of vibe that they gave off, that everyone was just sort of in love with them. And, you know, it things changed a little bit. But to your other point as well there, you know, about seeing these guys who have grown up, who I watched in the National Basketball League and the Australian League, and now I'm seeing their sons in the NBA, you know, Dante Exum, Ben Simmons, Jared Uthoff, he's also there. And there's one more who's just, I can't think of right now, but Jonah Bolden, that's it, from Philadelphia, even though I think he's going to be spending this season overseas. You know, I watched all their dads play, and they were all sort of expat Americans who went out and made the Australian League really, really good, because they're all very, very good players. And so it's really weird for me to see now their sons have come through and not only been good players, but NBA quality players. And added to that as well, Brett Brown, the coach of the 76ers, he spent a lot of years in Australia coaching. He coached under Lindsay Gaze, which even I think a lot of American basketball fans will know. Andrew Gaze, of course, is maybe Australia's most famous basketball player for his time at Seton Hall and the 89 NCAA championship run that they went on. Lindsay Gaines is actually in the Hall of Fame. He was inducted only a couple of years ago. And Brett Brown was an assistant coach under Lindsay, and then Brett Brown went on to coach himself and won a championship in the NBL. So there's just so many connections to the NBL that I used to watch and I used to follow, and it's really sort of trippy to now look and see that these sons of these players are playing, and not just filling in rosters by being the 10th or 11th man, but being stars on teams, and it's great to see.
Hey guys, what's up? Today is an awesome day because I'm holding in my hands a gift pack from none other than Barbasol Shaving Cream. And I can tell you now for a fact that the biggest thing to happen to Barbasol since their shaving cream is also the only thing to happen to Barbasol since their shaving cream. Introducing new Barbasol razors. The brand America trusts for a close, comfortable shave now has premium disposable razors. Barbasol's close shave technology on every razor means you get an advanced pivoting head and ultra-thin open-flow blades. The Ultra 6 Plus razor also features a seventh blade, specifically designed to refine and style tricky areas like under the nose, sideburns, and beard. I gotta say, the Ultra 6 Plus really keeps me clean. Go ahead and visit Barbasol.com and get a $2 savings coupon and see for yourself why Barbasol razors are the number one new disposable razors on the market. You're looking good, America. You're shaving with Barbasol. Check out Barbasol.com for that savings coupon. Let's fast forward to 2017 because, we're getting these emails from our listeners and they're telling us, hey, we're coming over to the NBA, the USA, basically to do like NBA road trips. I mean, they want to hit like, five games in 2 weeks, and they're going to go city to city and see all their favorite players. And we've got other guys who are, they've got fantasy teams and they're asking us to debate, where we put certain players on our SI Top 100 list. And I mean, it's clearly there's a lot of fans who are plugged in, but I'm curious just for like the American listeners, where does the NBA kind of fit into the sports landscape in Australia right now? I mean, there's a lot of other different sports I know that people follow religiously. I mean, the NBA is clearly not number one over there, I'm assuming. But where would you say it kind of ranks in terms of the other things they've got going on, whether it's Australian rules football, soccer? I mean, there's other sports that are taking place domestically. Where does the NBA fit? And also, how does it compare, I guess, to the Australian league? Would you say there's more basketball fans over there who are NBA fans, or are they, do they associate more with the local teams?
No, they're definitely more NBA fans. And again, a lot of it just comes back to the access they have. People can watch games, and, on League Pass, you can follow it. And the funny thing is, given that the games start usually at 7 p.m. Eastern time, that's perfect time in Australia for when you're at work. A lot of guys are, 11 o'clock in the morning, they turn on their computer and they're streaming an NBA game. So, it's not like you have to wake up at 2 in the morning to watch a game or anything like that. So it's perfect. I would say, I don't have obviously any stats, official stats on this, but I would say in Australian sporting ranks, I guess you've got Aussie rules and rugby sort of up there as sort of, joint one and two, and then you've got cricket when it's in season as well, and tennis and things like that. But I would say England Premiership soccer is still probably the most watched international sport. But then I would say basketball is right next to it. And I think, again, I think that a lot of the Steph Curry factor over the last couple of years has really given basketball a huge boost, because he's just made the game so incredible to watch, and the Warriors as well. I mean, like Klay Thompson as well. The way that he shoots and the way that the guys just play the game has just brought a whole new interest to the sport. So I would say, you've got soccer because it's just sort of still the global game, but basketball is right behind it. And I think that even sports like the NFL have probably benefited a little bit from the growth of basketball, the NBA in Australia, because people then start, when there's no basketball on, they start wanting to watch something else. And so American football is not a sport that we play in Australia. Not a lot of people follow it that closely, but now they're starting just to watch it, and they're just starting to consume it because they have access to it. So, I don't think that will sort of overtake basketball, because people don't play American football in Australia, and people play. And the good thing about basketball is boys and girls can play it. So it's got that sort of dual interest as well. It's not just a sort of boys sport. It's one for the whole family that they can play. And now, what we've had over these last couple of years, and yourself, Ben, from covering it, like, it's been incredible, like, the storylines that we've had, and, the combats that we've had, and seeing LeBron and him coming back from 3-1 last year to win the championship, like, sort of storylines that you can only dream of, and they've been happening. So people are really starting to take an interest. And, we get a lot of tweets and emails and stuff on our show, and I get people from, you know, Adelaide and Tasmania and Perth and Queensland, all around Australia, and they say, oh, I'm a huge Minnesota Timberwolves fan, and, you know, what can you tell me about the Wolves this year? And I, my first question is always, like, how do you become a Timberwolves fan growing up there? You know,
because exactly.
I understand if you're a, you know, if you're a Warriors fan, you know, or a Bulls fan, you know, from the 90s, Miami Heat, you know, I can understand why guys sort of, you know, and anybody who follows the league sort of feels an attraction to one of those teams. But, you know, the Wolves have never really been that close to winning a championship. Maybe in the late KG days, you know, back in 2004, there when they sort of probably got their closest. But, you know, people have been like, oh, man, I've been following them for the last 10 years. And I'm like, man, that's, you've done some tough, tough following there, you know. But I think that's it. Like, Australians like to sort of find a team for whatever reason, and they just go, right, that's my team, and I'm following this guy, these guys, you know, through thick and thin, and hopefully we get to a championship. Because, you know, again, I understand why a lot of people are Bulls fans. In fact, Nick Friedell, you know, the ESPN Bulls writer, I was talking to him not too long ago, and he was saying he went to Australia a couple of years ago, and people recognize him, and they know him on the street because of the impact that Jordan and the Bulls had in the 90s. So many kids grow up being Bulls fans. They're still Bulls fans now. And so when they see someone like Nick who covers them and does a great job, they recognize him and they want to talk to him. And, you know, they've got so many questions about it. So basketball fans, you know, sports fans in Australia, they're very, very passionate, very, very loyal and supportive of their team and of the league. And they just want as much information as they can because, you know, the other thing is you can't really come from Australia to America for just a long weekend. You know, if you're going to come, you know, as you're talking, some guys are saying, look, we're here for 2 weeks. We want to hit five or six different cities and get as much action as we can in as possible because you're only there for a short time. It's such a long flight. You want to make sure you make the most of it. And people will spend a lot of money just to get the experience of seeing a couple of games.
Yeah, the thing you're saying about the super teams, like with the Warriors, for example, I mean, that is one thing that, you know, here domestically, I think we do get a lot of backlash. Like, oh, it's the same two teams at the finals a couple of years. You know, eventually people get a little bit tired of it. But we shouldn't overlook or underestimate the importance of those greatness, you know, those teams that are sort of historically great, pulling in entire new fan bases, whether it's in Australia, China, other places. I mean, I think that is, you know, truly important. And your story about, you know, the lasting impact of the Bulls totally underscores that, and even just the immediate impact of the Warriors as well. Hey, I want to go back a little bit to 2012, because I believe the first time I met you was at the Basketball Jones, you know, no season required, a tour that you guys did in Portland. And you went city to city during the lockout and kind of spread the gospel about your podcast. And you guys were all based, I believe, in Toronto at that time. Was that right around the same time you realized that you could turn sort of, you know, your fandom or your love for the NBA into a potentially a career? Because that was before you were at NBA TV, I believe. I mean, was that really where it started to feel real? And what do you remember about that cross-country tour? I mean, I imagine that was just a crazy time in your life, not knowing if there was going to be a season, meeting all these fans that had probably followed you on social media for a few years before that. I mean, just walk me through that whole experience.
Yeah, well, I'll go back a little earlier than that because the Basketball Jones were working at the Score, and I wasn't a part of the crew back then. I was working at the Score, which is a all-sports TV network in Toronto, and sadly no longer exists. They sold out a couple of years ago. But at the time, I was working in the web department, and I was sort of shooting and producing and editing my own videos for all sorts of different sports. There was hockey, there was football, there was baseball, there was WWE, there was tennis and everything like that. And I knew about Skeets and Tass, but I didn't know them all that well, but I knew they did a sort of their daily podcast. And so when they joined the Score, I was trying to make myself known to them and trying to sort of say, hey, listen, I love basketball and, you know, I could really help you guys out. But they, you know, and there was a couple of things that I helped them, you know, behind the scenes with, but I wasn't officially a part of the team. And so ironically enough, I went to Australia around August or September of 2011. And just after I got back, I managed to just sort of stroll past their office one day, as I did often. And Matt and JD, the producers, were there, and they sort of said to me, "Hey Lee, come on in. We're going to ask you something." And I was like, "Yeah, sure." And they said, "What are you doing for the month of November?" And I was like, "Oh, you know, nothing, just working." And they said, "Well, we've proposed this basketball tour, this podcast tour around America, and we we basically need an extra pair of hands to help us out with a few things, and we want to offer it to you. And without even thinking, I was like, yeah, sure, I'm in, you know. And so there's a little bit more to that story. So my wife, Roxana, was actually pregnant with our first child at the time, and she wasn't due until April, so I knew I had a little bit of leeway, but I also thought to myself, I probably should ask her first, but I also didn't want to give the guys any reason to ask somebody else on that tour, because I thought whoever they would ask would take it, would snap up the opportunity in 2 seconds. So
it's a golden ticket.
Yeah, I'm in for sure. Yeah. And so when I went home, I said to my wife, we're having dinner, and, you know, I said, yeah, so the guys from the Basketball Jones have, you know, offered me this opportunity to do some work with them. And she's like, oh, okay, great. You know, that's what you want. And I said, yeah. And so I'm going to be on the road for 5 weeks. and there was a little bit of an awkward pause, but then she was, you know, totally supportive. And that's the one thing I have to say. My wife's always been incredibly supportive of everything I've done career-wise. And, you know, she understood it was going to be a bit of a tough time, you know, for me being away. But she also knew it was just the opportunity that really I had been waiting for. And so I didn't really know exactly what was going to happen on that trip. I don't think anyone really did. And you know, I think Portland was actually our second stop after Chicago. And as we were moving through the cities, we were sort of figuring it out as we were going along. I know that they were doing a podcast, and I say they because I wasn't involved in the actual on-air production of the podcast. I was sort of more doing little bits and pieces, whatever needed help getting set up and things like that, and taking photos and just trying to be a bit of a general lackey, really. And as the trip progressed, you know, I sort of tried to do a little bit more and tried to show the guys that I could, you know, shoot some video, produce some videos and do a little bit of editing. But also I was a huge basketball fan and you know, I would love to also, you know, have an opinion and have a voice on the show. But I was careful to not push it too much and to realize, you know, what my role was and what they'd invited me to do rather than, you know, try to sort of force my way onto the show. And then fortunately, it was around Miami, I think it was around Thanksgiving, when the NBA said they announced that the season would be coming back. And we went to New York and then we went to Boston. And I think it was JD and I were in a bar one night having a drink. And I sort of casually said to JD that I said, listen, I've really enjoyed this trip with you guys these last 5 weeks. And now that the season's coming back, if you'd need me to help, I'd love to sort of join you guys full time. And JD sort of had a sip of his beer and said, okay, you know, we'll have a think about it. And then I think we got back to Toronto and a couple of days after we got back, we all sort of went back and saw our wives and friends and girlfriends and all that sort of stuff. And then they said, yeah, we need you. So, you know, come welcome aboard, basically. And I was like, oh, this is fantastic. So, you know, that was really, you know, it's funny because a lot of people complain about the lockout and how bad it was for the NBA. But selfishly for me, the lockout was the best thing that ever happened to me because, you know, it really did give me an opportunity. And, you know, I like to think that I made the most of it and I took it. And it certainly has helped me to get where I am right now today. And you know, I mean, it's been 6 years now that I've been working full time, you know, with the Basketball Jones and the Starters, and that's flown by incredibly quickly. But you know, I've enjoyed every moment, and really, it is just one of those things that sometimes, you know, you just don't know when your opportunity is going to present itself. But when it does, if you can grab it with both hands, then you know, you make the most of it, and things can turn out really, really well.
No, I love it. I mean, your story it reminded me of like a Jimmy Butler or like a Wesley Matthews, you know, just a grind until your opportunity comes and then blow up and go with it. I love it. I'm wondering, now that you're in Atlanta at NBA TV, I mean, you've got the daily TV show, so you're, you know, getting recognized by guys all the time. And I know they send you like to the finals and All-Star Games, Summer League, I always see you in Vegas every summer. I mean, what was your welcome to the NBA moment? I mean, was it like the first time you really got to see like Shaq or Charles Barkley as a colleague, or was it interviewing somebody on the court maybe before a game, you know, somebody you'd respected for a long time? Was it running into a, you know, an NBA legend, you know, behind the scenes somewhere? I mean, do you have that welcome to the NBA moment that like players always talk about, but just do you have it from the media side?
Yeah, it's an interesting question because I fortunately had been interviewing players before we got to NBA TV. I'd been doing it at the Basketball Jones and also for The Score. So I wasn't quite, I never sort of had that sort of like, uh-oh, what am I going to do here type of moment. But for me, I guess the real moment was meeting someone like Isaiah Thomas, who, you know, I grew up, you know, really following the Pistons pretty closely, especially, you know, going back to our first conversation, I guess, like Pistons in the 87 and 88, that was when they really became a dominant team. And so Isaiah Thomas was the leader of that team. And being someone who was only 6 foot or 6 foot one, he gave hope and encouragement to small guys that you could still make it in the NBA if you work hard and you become, you know, tough and talented and disciplined and you do all those things that you're supposed to do, you may be able to make it to the NBA. So, you know, for me, when I actually met him and talked to him and also this is one of the things, you know, Skeets always brings up. When I talk to these guys, you know, Isaiah or whoever it is, I always talk to them about, you know, something that happened in the 88 or 89 playoffs or 91 or 92 or something, whatever sort of moment sticks out. And these guys, you know, a couple of times I know that the guys kind of stop and they're like, oh, yeah, wow, how do you remember that? And I was like, oh, well, you know, I just used to follow basketball. And I think they are a little surprised that an Australian guy does know a lot about things that happened in the 80s, because I don't think it happened to them all the time. But you know, now when I see like Kevin McHale around the office, I just really want to go up to him and talk to him about so many different things, and I try to not become too fanboyish about it. But sometimes it's also hard to not talk to these guys because they are colleagues now, and you know, you just want to ask them questions about their career and moments that happened, you know, that these guys that are famous moments and things that really stood out for me and things that I still remember pretty crystal clear. So I want to go up and talk to the guy who actually experienced it and who it happened to and see what they say about it. And, you know, so that's always fun for me. And I guess in a non-basketball way, one of the funniest sort of welcome to the NBA TV moments happened when it was just before a show. And I went into the bathroom just to sort of check my hair and, you know, neaten my shirt up and things like that. And as I came out of the bathroom, there was this gigantic shadow of a man standing over me. And you know, no, there was no doubt who it was. It was Shaquille O'Neal. And because I was coming out of the bathroom, he was waiting to go in. He just looked down at me and said, "Did you just have a number one or number two?" Totally, like, I was like, Shaquille O'Neal just asked me if I took a dump. Like, what has my life become? And I said to him, I said, "No, Shaq, it's fine. I'll just check my hair. You can go in there." And he's like, "Oh, I've got to be careful with these Canadian brothers." And like, Shaq thinks I'm Canadian. I haven't bothered to correct him. It's fine. There's worse things he could call me. You know, Shaq and Charles and Kenny, I think they all just say we're all Canadian because they know that Basketball Jones came from Toronto, even though myself and Trey are the only non-Canadians there. But, you know, again, it's not something that... even if I did correct Charles and Shaq, I don't think they would remember anyway if I told them I'm actually from Australia and, you know, I'm not from Canada. But, you know, so... Yeah, it's crazy that I see these guys around now, and you know, we are colleagues. You know, we're not. It's like the Charles Barkley who played on the Dream Team. That guy doesn't exist anymore. It's now Charles Barkley, the broadcaster, and you know, he's always entertaining. And you know, Charles will stop and have a chat as well. That's what I like about these guys, is that no one really has you know, sort of ignored us or even big timed us or anything like that. If we stop and we talk to these guys, you know, they love to have a chat. And, you know, especially, as I say, I mean, if I see Kenny the Jet Smith around and I talk to him about game one of the 95 finals where he hit those 7 three-pointers, he wants to talk all day about it. You know, you're not asking him about a shot that he missed or a turnover that he made that cost him a game. You know, you talk about a moment that really stands out for them. And those guys are happy to talk about it. So, you know, I like to sort of talk to them about stuff and just see what it was like at the time for them and them being in the moment. And, you know, it's this sort of, if I could tell the sort of 12 or 13-year-old version of me what was going to happen, you know, 20 or 30 years later, I wouldn't have believed it. So, you know, sometimes I like to just go back to being that kid and just asking these guys about something that happened and just seeing what they have to say about it.
No, I love it. You're like retroactively building memories that, you know, were impossible for you when you were growing up. That's so cool. Hey, I have kind of a random question for you, but you were mentioning, you know, the lengths that you were going to get the magazines and so forth. And I lived briefly in Israel when I was in fourth grade. And I remember, you know, I brought my basketball card collection over there and I remember showing it to the kids in Israel And it just, it lit up like they were bars of gold. Like they had never really seen anything like it. They couldn't believe it. They just wanted to touch them, turn them over. You know, some of them were, you know, doing what you're describing, you know, reading the stats off the back. And it was almost like it was a foreign language, you know, in addition to being in English, which, you know, wasn't necessarily their first language. But I'm wondering, was basketball cards, was that a thing in Australia? And then did I hear correctly on one episode where you said you were like mailing stuff to every single team, just trying to like blindly reach out to the PR departments to kind of collect memorabilia? I mean, how much of that was, you know, forming your basketball experience when you were a kid?
Yeah, well, that's all true. I mean, I got one basketball, it was like a preseason preview and had all the teams and all the conferences, although it was only four divisions at the time. And they had on one of the page, they had all the addresses of the team, of every team. And I think there was only actually 26 or 28 teams at the time. And so I remember just thinking, because originally my very first sort of team that I followed was just the Lakers, because it goes back to James Worthy in the 87 All-Star game, who had 22 points. And he was a real star, could have been the MVP, but because of the way things happened with Tom Chambers and Rolando Black, I won't go into all the details. But anyway, so I started following the Lakers, and I used to write to the Lakers a lot. And they were really good. They would always write back and send all sorts of things to me. So that sort of gave me the encouragement to write to other teams. And so I just basically wrote to, I would say, every team at least once or twice, and just said, I'm a big fan from Australia. I love, you know, if it's the New Jersey Nets, it was Buck Williams was my favorite player. And, you know, just hoping that they would respond and send me anything. And so many teams did. And it was so cool because it meant so much to me, even if it was just a little letter, an acknowledgement that just said, we got your letter, thanks for the support, here's a you know, postcard of the team or whatever it was. And I would keep all those things. And incredibly, when I moved out of home, Dad kept all those things. So now on
That's
our
awesome.
Set at Turner, yeah, on our set at Turner, there are some posters that used to hang on my bedroom wall that are now hanging on my workplace. You know, and you know, things like you'll see a lot of Lakers stuff and James Worthy posters and things like that. And there's two letters that I wrote just to the NBA head office. And I just asked them random questions, and they wrote back twice. And Dad kept those letters, and now we've got those framed up on the wall as well. And, you know, so for me, it's really cool, and it's something I do like to show off to people. And I say, you know, this is my education for basketball started when I was, you know, 10 or 11 years old. And I feel that it sort of helps me be in the position I'm in right now, because when I, you know, when we talk about comparing players or eras or whatever, I feel that I have that sort of that intellectual property, if you like, you know, of following the league from a very young age. And it helps at times now. But it also just sort of shows that, you know, when you were growing up watching it and following it, you know, how you've been a part of the league for so long. And so, you know, I could never have predicted it at the time. But now it's crazy that I'm sort of thinking about things that I was thinking about in high school at times, and relating it. And you know, you talk about the opening cards. You know, we do that sort of on our Facebook page once a week during the season. You know, usually on a Thursday we do it, you know, most Thursdays throughout the season, where I just open a packet of old cards from the sort of 80s or 90s or whatever. And I just sort of say whatever sort of comes into my mind. And usually it's some sort of crazy stat or fact that I remember from one of these games or from a magazine or whatever. And, you know, people seem to enjoy it. it's certainly weird. Like, I remember the first time we did it was actually in Toronto. It was Skeets' idea. He said, you know, why don't we just get a pack of basketball cards and open them and see what happens. And people loved it. People really seem to respond to it. So we seem to do that, you know, fairly regularly now. We miss it occasionally for whatever reason, but it's one of those things that people still seem to tune in for. And, you know, people even write to us and say, you know, can you open some more cards? We say, wow, this is crazy. But, yeah, I mean, I remember as well, like, basketball cards, I think, cost like, again, $1.50 US at the time. But by the time they sort of transported them to Australia, they were like $4 or $5 a pack. And, you know, I didn't have a lot of money back then, but I managed to scratch together, set at $15 or $20, and I'd buy four packs of cards. And, you know, that again, didn't think I was using my money as wisely as I could have been. But for me, it was just all about just get anything I can related to the NBA. And it was great. And then on top of that, when teams would send me memorabilia or posters or anything like that, You know, I would just take that, and it would just mean so much to me. And it's so funny now when I look back at some of that old stuff that I've got, like from the Knicks or the San Antonio Spurs and stuff. And it's like, wow, these, you know, all those, all that hard work, all those letters, they did pay off. And you know, it's great that I've still got some of those memories now that I can share with people, and I can show to people. And you know, everyone seems to appreciate and understand that it was like, you know, this little kid's dream sort of came to reality, and now I'm working in the industry, and I just, you know, it's a trippy experience.
All right, toughest question yet. I have my answer. I want to hear your answer. Best basketball card set ever. What year? What company? In terms of just your favorite, like which one do you think of when you think of like the most nostalgic era? What's the one that pops to your mind?
Well, it's probably that Skybox era.
Yes.
That had the art stuff. I think it's around 91 or 92.
Yes, you nailed it. So my favorite is 91, 92. Yeah. It's got the white background, right? Because there's the one before, the year before, they have like the gold background.
Yeah, and this would have like, say, you know, Reggie Miller, he'd have the ball in his hand, but then it'd have like a laser sort of thing coming off the ball type.
Yes.
You know. Yeah, that sort of stuff. That's probably, I think that's probably the one that stands out the most to a lot of people, because some of the cards in the earlier days were just like a photo of a guy, you know, maybe getting dunked on. So there's been some really weird cards over the years where a guy's like playing defense and it's his card, but you can barely see his face or anything. It's like, that's the best they could do for that guy. So I think when the creative aspect came to those Skybox ones, I think people were like, oh man, these are awesome. You know, but I don't know. I like the Hoops ones as well. I like the Hoops and the Upper Decks. I mean, the Upper Decks are legendaries as well. We try to mix it up with the Tops as well. The Tops, they were great. They're a great set. Yeah. It's funny, you know, because when we do open cards, it's great when you get a Michael Jordan or a Scottie Pippen, but it's even better when you get a Terry Teagle or someone like that in there, you know, or a Rod Higgins or a Winston Garland, you know, when you can sort of tell a story about, you know, whatever it is that I remember about that one player. You know, they're always more engaging and fun because everyone knows Jordan and Scottie and David Robinson and those guys. So if you can bring a little story out about a guy, one of my favorite ones actually is Michael Cage, the former Sonics and Clippers sort of power forward, really good rebounder in the late 80s and 90s. And I remember I got him in one card pack and I said, Michael Cage, he went 0-for-4 from the free throw line for the Seattle Supersonics in game 4 against the Lakers in the 89 Western Conference semifinals. And I just remember it because I've watched that game a million times, and Michael Cage, he just clunks 4 free throws. He goes 0-for-4. And it's a bit like Rain Man, you know. It just sort of stuck in my brain, and it'll probably never leave.
You know what's amazing is I opened up a box of 1991-92 Skybox, and they've got this futuristic art, like he's describing the balls on fire, and there's these weird graphics that kind of look like Microsoft Paint-y that they've got going on in the background. And, you know, they really do seem like, they're trying to be like 10 years in the future at that point, you know, based on the other designs that were going on. But when you open the box now, what's fascinating is how many of the guys are still involved in the league in one form or another. Maybe they're in a front office. Maybe they were a coach or an assistant coach. Maybe they're overseas somewhere. I mean, it really is a reminder that, like you're saying, there's on-court memories, but there's also, you know, it's a kind of a reflection now when you look back 20 years, 30 years, of how many of these guys are just still around the sport. That's kind of was my takeaway when I opened a box, you know, not too long ago. Was just like, man, there's like 150 guys in here who are employed by one of these teams, you know, in some capacity.
Yeah, well, and that's the thing, you know, like, you know, a lot of guys make it into the NBA, but they don't necessarily stick around for all that long, but they still want to stay close to the league, and whether that's an assistant coach or a front office role or whatever it is in broadcasting, you know, it just shows that, like, people just still love the game so much. And you know, it is great. It is awesome. Like, we had Fat Lever come onto our show this year.
Triple double machine.
With Russell Westbrook. Yeah, and you know, Fat Lever was known as the sort of triple double machine himself when he played as a small point guard. He's only 6'3", but a great rebounding guard. you know, but so for me, it was like, oh, I remember Fat Levy. You know, he started the 1988 All-Star game in Chicago. He was a great player. And so, you know, I see these guys and I'm like, wow, I wonder if he ever thinks about that game as much as I think about it. But, you know, it's just great. And I know that sometimes even in the office, you know, producer Matt will say, oh, you know, so-and-so is coming to town. Should we try to get him on the show? And it's a running joke in the office. I'm like, yeah, of course. Let's get this guy on. I'd love to talk to this guy about, you know, something. And they're like, well, Lee, we can't just talk to him about, you know, games that he played. We have to do something a bit more engaging. But, you know, that's something that I'm happy to sort of own. You know, I'd be happy to talk to these guys just about their career and you know, things that I remember and see how well they remember them.
Well, hey, on that front, you know, I'm looking at this 1987 NBA All-Star Game box score. And so for people who aren't as familiar as Lee with that game, which is the entire world, some of the guys who played: Magic Johnson, Tom Chambers, James Worthy, Hakeem Olajuwon, Alvin Robertson, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, late career Kareem. You know, in the East, you've got Moses Malone, Larry Bird, Dr. J, Michael Jordan, Dominique Wilkins, Kevin McHale, who you mentioned earlier, Isaiah Thomas, who you mentioned earlier, Charles Barkley. I mean, this is a laundry list, basically, of Hall of Famers. But my question to you, and because I know you study this stuff, when you look at the NBA now, 2017, pace and space, everybody wants to be like the Warriors. The centers are shrinking. Everybody's taking more three-pointers than ever. It's all about the quick ball movement. When you look back on those 80s greats, or even the guys into the 90s, I think my sweet spot was more like early to mid-90s. I think yours is kind of that late 80s. How many of those guys do you think could still be Hall of Famers if they had to play their careers in the modern NBA? I mean, which of the guys jumped to mind to you as like no-brainer Hall of Famers? And then which of maybe the real superstars do you think would have struggled to make the transition?
Yeah, wow, that's a great question. I mean, obviously Jordan and Magic and Larry, I don't think those guys, I think their skills and their abilities transcends across any era. You know, Larry obviously wasn't the most athletic player at the end of his career, but still it was just an incredibly talented player who was able to adapt to play the game with the body that was falling down and, you know, breaking down in those last couple of years. So I think those sort of guys are fine. Personally, I think someone like Hakeem Olajuwon as well would still be a star in today's game. Just an incredibly dominant player at both ends of the floor. Could, you know, in my mind, probably the best defender we've ever had in the NBA, just his ability to block shots and to intimidate opponents as well. You know, I mean, he's the all-time leader in block shots, but he's probably doubled that for a amount of shots that he's never had to block because guys wouldn't go up against him. So I think guys like him, Kareem, obviously, as well. I mean, he was a star, and, you know, the sky hook is something that's never been replicated, and he was totally dominant. Yeah, I wonder if someone like Dominique Wilkins would be as revered as well as he is now if he played in the current game. I'm not sure, because he was athletic and, you know, incredibly good at, you know, the dunks and stuff, but he wasn't a great shooter of the ball, I wouldn't think, either. So I'm not sure if the game would sort of have been as kind to him now, being, you know, having to be a sort of guy who could knock down a three-pointer. He wasn't a great three-point shooter. You know, someone like Bill Laimbeer is an interesting one as well, because if you look at the way the modern game is now, as you mentioned, you know, big men are all stepping back, knocking down three-pointers. But Bill Laimbeer was one of the first to do that. And he was, I believe, a four-time All-Star as well. So he was a very, very good player, even though he's probably one of the most despised in the history of the league, because everyone hated playing against him. But he was kind of a front-runner as well. Like a leader, I guess, in that respect, that he understood to make himself valuable. It was important that he played defense, but he had to find a way to make himself a decent three-point shooter. Now, he, by today's standards, he barely shot the three-pointer, but, you know, he's someone who at least saw that he could offer something to his team that they needed, and it helped out. So, I don't know, because, again, he wasn't super athletic, if his style of play would be as effective now, but, you know, certainly someone who sort of, I guess, saw the game developing perhaps into you know, needing to shoot the three-pointer. So it's hard, because you certainly don't want to disrespect anyone who's a Hall of Famer, and they just because of the era that they played in, that they wouldn't be able to play in it now. But I guess the athleticism as well of guys now stands out a lot more. I mean, you think of LeBron James at 6'8", and he basically is a point guard who can play power forward and center, which is, if you had the equivalent at the time, someone like Karl Malone, if he was a point guard who could play center and could throw the ball down like LeBron and shoot three-pointers, I mean, you wouldn't believe that a guy could develop into a playmaker like that and to be an all-round talent like that. But that's basically what LeBron has become. So, you know, someone like Karl Malone, very, very hard to defend and second all-time in points because of his ability to use his body, get to the free throw line and score the ball. But, would that be as in demand these days? Would that, would coaches and teams seek out a guy who doesn't really spread the floor, but he can just use his size to score a lot of points? But, of course, we know now that teams value the three-pointer so much more than just getting two-pointers and getting to the free-throw line. So, it's very hard. It's very hard to sort of say, well, this guy just wouldn't have been able to make it, because if he'd grown up in this era, maybe Karl Malone can shoot a three-pointer. Maybe
I was just going to say, instead of the pick and pop at 15 to 18, I think he's just popping out to that angle three, and he's, Stockton's just feeding him on those shots all day long, and he's knocking down the threes. Or a guy like Larry Bird, instead of a couple of threes a game, he's probably being encouraged to take 8 or 9 threes. I mean, it seems like with some of these legends, the modern game actually maybe could have enhanced their stats or enhanced their profile if they had grown up playing that way, like you're saying.
Well, exactly. I mean, you're right. If Larry Bird shot, as many threes a game as Klay Thompson does, Larry Bird may be one of the all-time leading scorers, because he would have just knocked down more threes. But, of course, back then, it just wasn't regarded as the weapon it is right now. And I mean, weapon's probably not even the right way to describe it right now, because everyone shoots it. And I mean, as soon as the ball's tipped off, teams are just bombing away, like the Rockets. Basically, as we know, they either shoot a three-pointer or they're trying to drive it into the paint. The mid-range game just no longer exists for them. So, but like Karl Malone, someone like him, I mean, with John Stockton as well, who they just had such incredible chemistry, I'm sure they would have figured out a way to get him plenty of looks and still getting him, rolling to the hoop and scoring. So, it's hard to sort of say that obviously a guy like that wouldn't have worked in today's era, but, someone who was so powerful and so dominant and so consistent as well, Karl Malone, talk about an Iron Man. He barely missed any games throughout his career. He took incredible care of his body. And, that's why he was able to score so many points and a very physical player as well. So he took a pounding, and he certainly gave out a fair bit of treatment as well on the defensive end. But, the game, I'm not sure who the modern-day equivalent of a guy like that would be right now, just off the top of my head. I mean, maybe it was sort of Kevin Love a few years ago, but even that doesn't really seem to sort of translate all that well. But, Carl just happened to play in an era where he was able to really utilize his skills and his advantages and, become an incredible player and a Hall of Famer.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, we're running short on time, so I wanted to help you, have you clear up a controversy that I've gotten in with Australia a few years ago. Now, back in 2014, Australia was in the FIBA World Cup, and they had a game against Angola. Now, there was, I guess, some seeding at stake. It was sort of the last game of the group round where, if Australia lost, it was going to be more beneficial for them. So they get into this really weird game where the second half just becomes this dunk parade for this Angolan team that wasn't very good. And all of a sudden, Australia's offense becomes, very perimeter-oriented. They're not really driving to the hoop. And so I put together some clips from that game, and I put it up, and actually some NBA players who were watching the game kind of accused Australia of potentially tanking that game for the seeding, and it led to an investigation. Eventually, Australia was cleared of not tanking, but Andrew Gaze, who you mentioned earlier, Australian basketball legend, he was sending some Twitter shots at me for, accusing Australia potentially of tanking. I'm wondering, do you remember this whole controversy back in 2014, and did Australia play that game fairly, if you do remember it, or were they trying to play it kind of like, in some of these other sports, whether it's soccer or whether it's badminton? I mean, there's been these other tanking controversies. I mean, do you remember what I'm talking about here?
Yeah, I do. Australia tanked for sure. There's no doubt
about
that game. Yeah, I remember watching it, and you know, as you mentioned, their offense was just awful, and Angola just seemed to just stroll into the paint and score. And you know, the thing is, it's funny when you see it. Like, to me, it was obvious; it was pretty clear that that's what's happening. But people get outraged by it. But you know, across every sport, at some level, we've all seen it. We've seen it in the NBA. You know, I know that the NBA certainly doesn't like to advertise that it's happened, and it probably hasn't happened as much in the last couple of years, I guess. But we know that teams tank. You know, they do that because they want to improve a position. And when you're talking about a world championships, Australia wanted to avoid America, I believe, is what it was. I mean, that probably is the only team that really makes sense that you want to avoid. But that happens, you know, and you know, Australia obviously not going to come out and say, oh yeah, we tanked, because then that looks bad. But at the same time, you can watch that game and you just go, well, we know that you clearly weren't trying as hard as you could, because if you had, you would have defended better, you would have shot the ball differently, and you would have just taken better shots. So, you know, it happened, and I don't, you know, I know that there's always going to be two sides to an argument like that. So, no, we're trying. We had a bad day and the shots weren't falling, and that happens. But that was a pretty weak defence by Australia to say that that they didn't tank that game. That was pretty clear. If you've watched as much basketball as you know, you and me and a lot of guys have, and a lot of people have throughout their lives, you can pretty much tell when a team's trying to lose, and that's what Australia's trying to do that day.
Well, I feel very validated. Australian basketball legend Andrew Gaze. I have my own Australian basketball legend Lee Ellis backing me up here finally in this debate. So this feels excellent. Hey Lee, before we go real quick, tell people where they can find your work and you know, go ahead and plug what you're doing on Twitter and what you maybe have coming up here for the new NBA season.
Yeah, well, NBA TV is where we have the show 5 nights a week, Monday to Friday during the season. Our first show, our preseason show, is usually early October, with the season starting a little earlier this year. We haven't actually got a date knocked out just yet, but look for that. It'll be very, very early in October. We also have the Twitter show, which is Tuesdays at 8 a.m. Eastern, 11 a.m. Eastern time. That's live on Twitter, and that's a little bit of a different show that we do, but we did it last season. It was a lot of fun. We all enjoyed that, where we talk about basketball. We also sort of go off the rails a little bit and talk about a few other things, and we really encourage viewer participation, because it's on Twitter, so you just have to get onto Twitter and you can watch it. So that's every Tuesday at 11 a.m. and then we also have the Drop podcast, which is our Friday audio only podcast. That's pre-recorded, usually gets up around sort of noon, 1 p.m. Eastern every Friday, and that's also heavily into basketball, but we also go off on a few different tangents from time to time and talk about a few other things. So that's where you can find the show. My Twitter handle is just my name, Lee Ellis, L-E-I-G-H-E-L-L-I-S. You can follow me there if you want to see what I have to tweet. And yeah, I mean, we sort of haven't really got together and started talking about next season yet. I mean, it's early August, mid August, I guess, while we're recording this, and we've been off since the end of summer league, and most of us have kind of gone off in our own different directions and gotten away from each other. When you spend 10 months in each other's close proximity to each other, the first month you get off, you tend to try to find other people to talk to, and you don't want to talk about basketball that first month. But we'll get together probably in the next couple of weeks and start discussing a few ideas about what we're going to do this season, because we always like to try to keep things fresh and try to keep things new and exciting. And you know, that's the challenge that we face every year, is to hope that people still find us entertaining and informing, and people still like to follow along. So that's kind of where we stand right now. And as I say, we'll definitely be back on in October. So follow our Facebook, the Starters on Facebook, and our Twitter handle and Instagram as well. That's where we'll have all that information when we've figured it all out.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Lee. Say hi to Skeets, Taz, Trey, all those guys for me. I've been a fan since they were shooting, I guess, in Skeets' apartment, billiards room. So, I mean, it's been awesome to see you guys rise up and take over NBA TV. And again, thanks so much for the conversation, all the information about Australia's love affair with basketball. I'm sure our listeners really appreciated that. Thanks again, Lee.
My pleasure, Ben. Thanks for having me, man.
Another great edition of Open Floor is in the books. Did you know Locked On has a daily podcast for all 30 NBA teams? If you're a Lakers fan, search Locked On Lakers. A Celtics fan, search Locked On Celtics. Warriors fans, search Locked On Warriors. Yes, all 30 NBA teams have a daily bite-sized podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team.
It's the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.